Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the Tennis Podcast. I'm Catherine Whittaker. David Law is here. Hello, David.
Hello. We've got quite a lot to talk about, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Matt Roberts is here.
Hello, yes. Waiting for the day when I don't turn on to Twitter and find myself ashamed of tennis.
Have you prepared your razor-sharp tongue for this week, Matt? Because that is what the people are going to come to expect from you now.
Something to live up to, yes. Yes, well, I mean, I feel like the event has done that for us, really.
Yes. So the Adria Tour had its first iteration in Belgrade last weekend. That was what we were discussing on the podcast last week. It then moved on to Zadar in Croatia. And there was a match on Saturday night in Zadar between Grigor Dimitrov and Borna Coric, during which Dimitrov looked very clearly, very visibly, well, more than out of sorts. He looked quite clearly ill, frankly. He lost very one-sidedly in straight sets to Coric, didn't shake hands with Coric at the net, and in previous matches, all the players had been showing no signs of reluctance about touching, shaking hands, hugging, all sorts of things, which we'll talk about in more depth later. But no handshake, did the coronavirus elbow bump instead, didn't shake hands with the umpire. And there was sort of some chatter about it on social media at the time. I think, David, you mentioned that Dimitrov didn't look quite right. Well, about 24 hours later, he posts a picture of himself on Instagram back home in Monte Carlo saying, "I've flown home and I've tested positive for COVID-19. At which point, as you can imagine, tennis kind of erupts, sport erupts, kind of, you know, news erupts. This is a story that certainly transcends tennis and to a certain extent transcends sport, unfortunately. Subsequent to that, we've had all players besides Novak Djokovic, seemingly, that were involved in the Adria Tour being tested. We've had Borna Coric confirming that he has tested positive despite being asymptomatic. We know that a certain proportion of cases do tend to be asymptomatic. There were also two other confirmed cases. They're believed to be two members of player support teams, two coaches, fitness trainers, not quite sure. There is some speculation that one of them is Dimitrov's coach, fitness trainer, and another is a member of Djokovic's team, but we don't have confirmation of that. I mentioned Djokovic there. All we've heard from him is that he has returned home to Belgrade because he wasn't experiencing any symptoms and said he intended to get tested once home in Belgrade. And just in the last hour, we record this at Harper State UK time on Monday. Just in the last hour, we've had confirmation from the Serbian journalist Saša Osmo that Djokovic has had the test at home in Serbia. He expects to get the results in 24 hours, at which point he is expected to speak to the press. Djokovic, of course, not just a player involved in the event, but also responsible for hosting the event and pulling the whole thing together. It is a story that is at once completely unreal and also completely depressingly predictable based on what we were seeing and talking about last week. And I, even as we were saying those things that we did on the podcast last week, I was still thinking, but surely they must know something that we don't. If they're doing that, then surely they must have some kind of assurances that the risk is close to nil, because nobody would be that stupid or reckless or irresponsible. But ye of too much faith, I suppose, because unfortunately our worst fears, not just ours, but you know, much of the tennis community, they've all come true.
Mm. And I was thinking back, I actually listened back to our show from last Wednesday, because I'd had quite a lot of correspondence from listeners, which was split. Some people felt that I was being too hard on the event and not giving enough credit for the fact that Serbia is a country which, and I, when I listened back, we did say that there are very few cases in Serbia of coronavirus. There are very few deaths, same in Croatia. And the restrictions are not what they are here in the UK, which is obviously one of the really seriously hit areas. But at the same time, that it looked to me terrible in this climate. It looked like they were just ignoring the fact that there was a pandemic on and just carrying on as if tennis was tennis from 6 months ago. So I was focusing then really at the time on how it looked and how, the message that it was sending to the world and to all the fans of these players, whilst having in the back of my mind that really let's think about this. If one of these players or anybody from their teams or anybody around happens to have coronavirus, given the way they're behaving, given the way they're dancing in nightclubs together, very close up, shaking hands, handing towels to ball kids, being pictured with literally hundreds of people, young people, old people, everybody in Zadar over the last weekend and the weekend before in Belgrade. If one person had it, the potential for disaster is there. And I just sort of end up feeling last week that, and my conclusion was, it will probably be okay. It'll probably be okay. But even so, it doesn't feel right. Well, it's not okay. Grigor Dimitrov has brought coronavirus with him to Serbia and to Zadar. Or he's picked it up when he's there.
Well, I mean, almost that's best case scenario, that Grigor Dimitrov brought it with him, that he's patient zero. I mean, because he's traceable and he's a known quantity. I mean, who knows who he got it from, where, you know, who knows where the trail goes back to.
Yeah. And the other half of people there were a couple of people who wrote to us and said, you know, this isn't just about optics. This is about the irresponsibility and potential danger that this event is putting people in. And in hindsight, actually, I would agree with that. I still understand. I still feel that what I said last week is what I would say now if I didn't have the hindsight I have right now. But it had the potential, and that potential has been realized.
But optics are also part of that, because it sets an example. You know, Novak Djokovic is as big a star as there is in Serbia, as big a figurehead. He's somebody that doesn't shy away from leadership type roles and spokesmanship type roles. You know, we'll come on to the fact that he's head of the Players Council. Him staging that event in the way that he did sent a message out to the region and the world that this behavior is okay. And you know, he's usually somebody that's pretty aware of his responsibilities in that kind of regard. So to hide behind statements such as, you know, we followed the guidance in those regions at the time feels pretty flimsy. And Matt, you've looked up exactly what that guidance is and was, and it doesn't sound like a, hey, go and throw a big tennis event and do a load of hugging and have a kids' day and go to a club and do some sweaty grinding. to me.
No.
Is that what the guidance said?
I genuinely do not understand how this event was allowed to take place when you read through the guidance. The Adria Tour official statement when they called off the final in Zadar said that at all times we've strictly followed the epidemiological measures in place in the countries where the Adria Tour was organised. Well, the first thing to note there is that Montenegro was supposed to host the third leg of this. They seemed to take one look at everything that was happening in the Serbia leg and say, you're not having that here. They sort of cancelled themselves that leg of the tour even before any of these positive cases were confirmed. And the second thing is, yeah, you have a quick look at the Serbian government advice listed on their COVID-19 information page. And it says that the outbreak is ongoing and it's recommended to follow preventive measures to reduce the risk of transmission. And then the measures listed are avoid hugging, cheek kissing, shaking hands with others, and keep the recommended distance of at least 1 meter between yourself and others, and use a face mask to cover your mouth and nose when staying indoors. So to read that and to see the images that we saw through both legs of the Adria Tour just doesn't add up at all. The irony of the fact that the first time I've seen a tennis player involved in that event wearing a mask is Grigor Dimitrov in presumably his hospital bed having just tested positive. I mean, the recklessness, the thoughtlessness, the obliviousness of it all is really shocking and shameful, I think.
And the World Health Organization advice is even if you test negative, if you have come into contact with somebody that has tested positive, you should self-isolate. Now, Novak Djokovic's statement about returning to Belgrade, that is a violation of the regulations. Dominic Thiem travelled to the south of France for the Ultimate Tennis Showdown now and played a match. Now, we know he tested negative upon arrival. He subsequently tested negative, they say, a further 2 times. But strictly the advice is if you know you've come into contact with an infected person, you should be self-isolating. And that is what Marin Cilic has announced that he is doing. He's received a negative test, but he intends to self-isolate for 2 weeks. Andrei Rublev, the same. I think the best of the statements that I've seen so far has been from Alexander Zverev. He says, I've just received the news that my team and I have tested negative for COVID-19. I deeply apologise to anyone that I have potentially put at risk by playing this tour. I will proceed to follow the self-isolating guidelines advised by our doctors. As an added precaution, my team and I will continue with regular testing. I wish everyone who's tested positive a speedy recovery. Stay safe. Now, it doesn't change the fact that his playing that event was flipping stupid, and it always was flipping stupid. You didn't have to have that much hindsight or judgment, I don't think, to realise that it was at best an extremely naive thing to do. But that strikes closest to the right tone of any statement I've seen so far. It's going to be very, very interesting what we hear from Novak Djokovic, provided we do hear from him tomorrow evening. P.S. David Law has already raised the prospect of an additional podcast tomorrow evening, 2 in 2 days. Snuck that in while we were prepping for this one. Of course he did.
This is just our training for Wimbledon, really. Yeah.
It's going to be very interesting, is it? I mean, I personally want him to appear in his back garden on a white picnic table with a really crap tablecloth and some papers in front of him with his sleeves rolled up and explain that he was just testing his eyesight the whole time.
And if you don't know what Catherine's referring to, just read Simon Briggs's piece, which has an intro about the parallels to Dominic Cummings, the British Prime Minister aide, who went through that.
I thought you were going to say British Prime Minister then, and I wasn't going to correct you.
Who went through that same process, or at least a similar one, a few weeks ago. I think there's a lot at stake here. Obviously there is, but even from here, the fact that Novak Djokovic has said nothing in the last 24 hours, bothers me immensely. He is the head of the player council. He is the world number one. He is the, from what I understand, the organizer of this tour, at least the figurehead, the inspiration behind it. And he has brought all of these people together. They have flagrantly disregarded all social distancing advice and on the understanding that everything will be fine, and it isn't fine. So you've got some explaining to do right there. And to have radio silence for 24 hours is really disturbing to me. Now, I hope that when he does speak, and I suspect it will probably be more to his fans than the media, I think is what I would imagine, but we'll see. I just hope he gets this right and really understands the gravity of the situation, and that he needs to send a message that this was the wrong thing to be doing. And goodness me, let's hope that Grigor Dimitrov gets better, that Borna Coric is okay, that all of these people make a full recovery, and that we don't see a spike of cases all the way through the region.
All the people that were there that don't have the access to private jets to get them home and high priority with testing. Mm. You know, do all the people that were in that nightclub with them, all the people that came to the event, all the people that were at that kids' day, what's their access to testing like?
I can't stop thinking about the photographs that we've seen of Coric and Dimitrov surrounded by kids. You know, that is going to be a defining image. It's like a frozen image of time of tennis behaving irresponsibly during the pandemic. And goodness knows, let's hope that no one in those photos is infected. But, you know, it's reasonable to assume that other people will be who were in the crowd at this event or, as you said, in those nightclubs, in those kids' days, because we know how contagious this virus is. And
whenever we see the pictures of the Cheltenham Festival and the many, many thousands of people crammed together in, was it March?
And yeah, it's haunting.
It's haunting. It gives you a shudder every single time you see that and you realise the way that the virus then took off in Britain and the numbers. What have we got? 60,000 expected to have died if you count all the care home deaths as well. Now, I know that that's not a single source, but it was a symbol, really, of the country just not taking it seriously at the time. And God forbid that has happened, that something tragic happens here, and that is the image that we will see.
And I think, you know, Coric and Dimitrov to me feel like the kind of well-meaning kid at school who gets caught up with the wrong crowd and mixing and doing something they'd kind of know they shouldn't be doing, but they at the same time they should know better, and they should have thought this event doesn't feel right. But there's a responsibility with someone, and it feels like mainly Djokovic as the organizer of this event and anyone who helped him organize it, that this was not the right thing to be doing. And, you know, frankly, it's a kind of extension of what Djokovic was talking about on his Instagram lives. It's two fingers up at science, and it's saying, I'm above this and I'm invincible. I'm a tennis player. I'm fit. I'm strong. I'm healthy. Let's show them that we've beaten this virus. And they hadn't. And, you know, other people are adjusting their lives and changing the way they're living, and they're going about doing this. And I'm sorry, but it leaves such a bad taste, and now it's endangering lives. And I mean, we can't stress the seriousness of this, really.
By the by, not that it's hugely relevant, but there is actually quite a lot of evidence, data suggesting that athletes, top-level athletes, are actually more prone to contracting not just coronavirus, but other similar viruses as well, due to the way that their bodies function. But, you know, not that Djokovic is guff about, you know, making water pure by dancing around it or something. It needs debunking, but, you know, there's just one bit of debunking that can be done. And it's, you know, it's all very funny, isn't it, when it's just somebody when it's just somebody having slightly, well, not slightly, but wacky views, but you can sort of say each to their own, not doing anyone any harm. Well, it's doing harm now. It's doing harm. And, you know, science is not just another opinion.
And, you know, when we were watching the coverage a week ago, and when we were talking about it, even in last week's podcast, I often find myself trying to self-assess whether we, and not just we, but everybody in the media, is being too harsh on Novak Djokovic generally, because he comes in for a lot of stick, and we are often criticised for giving him stick, or certainly the British media are, and people feel that that we've got it in for him. And when I self-assess, I'd always try to just get the balance, just be fair, just get the balance right. And there is no way around this. There's no way around it. There's no way of sugarcoating this. And like I say, I hope he's able to give answers tomorrow, or a statement that can, in the same way as Alexander Zverev has, just at least make you realize that he's understood the seriousness of it all. There was also, just to say, there was a match that I was watching last week from the Adria Tour, and Eurosport had got the rights to it. And there's sort of one of those things that when you get the rights to something, there's a bit of pressure at times for a broadcaster to not be negative about the event that they are covering. And I think that in recent years, particularly with the proliferation of world feeds becoming more and more significant, and fewer stations putting their own commentary teams on things, and just literally taking a feed and putting it out there, and often that feed is arranged by the tournament itself or the tours themselves, that has increased, and there's less criticism out there. But there was a moment watching, I can't remember who was playing last week in Belgrade, but Chris Bradnam, very experienced commentator, and he was on his own in the commentary box, nobody alongside him. And there was a moment where he just said, you know, I'm trying to bite my lip here, but I cannot believe that there are still ball kids on this court going up and taking sweaty towels from tennis players. And I remember thinking, good for you, Chris, because that has been bothering me for the last half an hour. And, you know, we as commentators, yeah, you've got to say it how it is. Otherwise you lose credibility. And I was really pleased to hear him say that. And it was an important message to just send out, because this is not okay.
Nick Kyrgios has sent out the same message, as you might expect.
What's he said?
A lot of it was in caps. did he use it? Was knucklehead
bonehead.
The word he...
Bonehead.
Sorry. Boneheads. Something about the boneheads involved with making the Adria Tour happen. And ended his tweet in caps with, "This is not a joke." And that's, I mean, we were saying just before we started recording, Matt, when David was busy having internet problems and plotting extra podcasts. you said, oh, I already missed the days when we could make lighthearted jokes about Dominic Thiem playing far too much tennis all over the world. Now it's all really sinister. The thought, you know, David looked at his schedule and said, bloody hell, he's down to play an exhibition in Austria on Thursday. I mean, I know he's tested positive. I know he's tested negative, but strictly, he should be self-isolating. The tests are not 100% accurate. And actually taking multiple tests doesn't help in that regard, because it's not the tests that are faulty. It's the way that your body interacts with the test. So if you get a false positive or negative once, you will most likely get the same false results subsequent times. So, and whether it's actually reckless or not, he just needs to be seen to be doing the right things, to be setting the examples. They all do. They just need to be seen to be saying, this is serious here. I need to not even think about thinking about putting a foot wrong. Everything has to be the letter of the law. There's no making up for what's gone before. All I can do is try and set it right now. And I don't know. I don't know. Is it staggering naivety? Is it arrogance? Is it stupidity? What is it?
Because, well, it's very difficult to say, isn't it?
All of these people have enormous teams around them. They employ countless advisors and experts, obviously not epidemiologists or anything, but managers and agents and fitness people who you'd expect to have some sort of appreciation of public health, etc. I mean, it's so out of touch from what we're all experiencing and our thought processes on a daily basis that it is quite hard to wrap your head around.
So somebody I heard say when Nick Kyrgios is the one who sounds like he's the sensible one.
Voice of reason.
And then we had today Dan Evans in a virtual press conference ahead of the Battle of the Brits tournament, which is due to start tomorrow, organised by Jamie Murray, six British male doubles teams, and looks like it'll be a pretty good event down in the National Tennis Centre. And Jamie was talking about the event, and he was being asked about this, and he's clearly cottoned on immediately what's at stake here. They'd already got a lot of safety measures in place for testing and for social distancing, and had clearly been taking it very seriously. And when this news had broken, it was clear from what he said as well that they'd had a player meeting, he said, and reminded each other of that you can't let your guard down. And I'm thinking, well, that's exactly right. That's exactly what you should be doing. Then Dan Evans came in, and I know some people will listen to what Dan Evans has got to say and think, well, I'm not going to be lectured by Dan Evans who failed a doping test 2 years ago. But actually his words were absolutely on the money. And regardless of who they come from, you know, he got it absolutely right, because he said this should not be happening. And that the world number one and the leader of the player council should be showing a better example.
Mm. What do we think about? I mean, until we've heard from him, the player council thing is potentially premature to discuss, but is it a position that seems untenable?
I think I saw John Wertheim tweet this evening that he'd heard rumblings among players that some, you know, quite a lot were unhappy with Djokovic still holding that position and kind of watch this space kind of thing. And Dan Evans said the same, really, didn't he? Not in certain terms, but he said, you know, he was asked, "Do you think it's a position that he shouldn't be holding?" And he said, you know, the tone of your question has kind of explained how I'm feeling. But I do wonder now. You know, I think when we were talking about the US Open coming back on whenever it was Wednesday, it's a podcast, we were expecting some bumps in the road and the situation to kind of change. Obviously, we've got a massive one immediately. And I just think, throwing it long term, what is the implications of this for the tour's return? And I think the key question is, can you trust 300, 400 tennis players all in one place to behave? Because it's only going to take one or two to break protocol, and the whole thing at the US Open is going to kind of implode. I mean, they are going to have social distancing, more safety protocols, so it should be a safer event than the Adria Tour. But one or two going against those, and you've got a big, big problem. So I do wonder whether it will make some players who are on the fence think, I'm not getting involved in that if, you know, tennis players have shown themselves to be like this, or whether it will just be a massive wake-up call, and whether it will kind of crystallise it in people's mind that they need to follow these restrictions.
And as Andy Murray said, he spoke to the press yesterday, I think, he said, well, he said that pandemic situation permitting, he does intend to play the US Open. He said he'll make an assessment about how safe it is closer to the time. But he also made the point that I haven't thought of before in relation to what you're just saying there, Matt, about what are the penalties for not sticking to any of this? I mean, throughout this whole thing, that's been kind of one of the murky areas across the board, hasn't it? Even the official government regulations, it's been unclear whether any of them are actually, and which of them are written into law, which of them are punishable by fines or police measures, and which are just a sort of polite request from our government that we act in the spirit of the greater good. Well, I think it's been pretty well proven that tennis players potentially can't be trusted to be motivated by the greater good. So maybe some penalties need to be in place for those that do commit transgressions.
Mm. I mean, I do feel that the tours are a very different story, because there are going to be proper measures in place. They are going to have to reach the sanctions that, you know, put into place the provisions that are required to meet tour level. And you can imagine now more than ever just how extreme those might well be. And when we were listening to the US Open plans, they were talking about their bubbles and they were talking about their social distancing and if their ability to keep people apart by the sheer size of the place. But they also did, as you say, Matt, they talked about people needing to take some responsibility, because they were going to allow those houses to be rented. They were going to not insist on everybody staying in just this kind of quarantine-like circle around the site. They were going to at least let people go somewhere else, and they're relying on people to play by the rules. But I do feel that this is so egregious, because you've got people clearly passing it on one to the next, stood right there with their arms all around each other. We're not going to have that, at the very least, you would expect. But I mean, the stakes are so high and the people are so fidgety as well that there has to be the potential for long-term problems as well if it's not taken seriously right now.
Shall we close entries now for the tennis shoots itself in the foot category of our year-end awards?
or
would I be tempting fate by doing that? And tomorrow we'll find that somehow tennis has shot itself in the foot in an even more catastrophic way. How could that be possible? What would it have to do? What would tennis have to do?
What sort of pathetic, minuscule thing happened last year that won it? I can't even remember.
I remember campaigning for or nominating the abolition of the Hotman Cup. But I don't think that won. Do you remember what you nominated, Matt?
I nominated the Women's French Open semi-finals.
Oh, yes.
I think, being on the Simone Mathieu court at about 11
o'clock
in the morning.
Yeah.
They were great problems, weren't they?
Yeah.
I miss our old problems.
I mean, I literally every day I'm thinking, you know, I go to bed thinking, right, that was the nadir of tennis. And then the next day, something else happens. Please, tennis, get your act. Actually, I should rephrase that, because it's always the men. Men's tennis, get your act together, for goodness sake.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool.
Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
More men's tennis coming at you tomorrow, Matt. It's the Battle of the Brits. Starts tomorrow at the National Tennis Centre in Roehampton. That's why you two were speaking to, or certainly listening to, the great and the good of British tennis earlier on today. It's Tuesday through Sunday. It's singles and doubles. Starts at 1 p.m. with Jamie Murray, Neil Skubsky against Liam Brody, Cam Norrie in doubles. Then it's three singles matches and finally a doubles match. The notable singles tomorrow, probably Andy Murray against Liam Brody, fourth match of the day. You've got Kyle Edmund against James Ward, Dan Evans against Jay Clark, and then Murray versus Brody. Kyle Edmund versus Andy Murray, they've been drawn in a group together. That is a match that will happen on Wednesday. That's probably the pick of the group stage matches. So it's an 8-man singles draw and a 6-team doubles draw, all of them British and all of them men. There is an equivalent women's tournament being organised. Details and player field are still yet to be announced, I believe, but it's certainly, although just as with this one, the LTA are involved in the organisation and assisting with it. It's a Jamie Murray led venture, and the women's event is an entirely separate venture that the LTA are assisting with. So I'm really glad that women's equivalent exists and is going to exist. I think it's a shame that this men's event came out with all the fanfare, and as is so often the case, it kind of felt a bit like the women's was an afterthought or an add-on. But I'm interested in it. I'm going to watch it. I'm definitely interested to see what kind of shape Andy Murray's in.
Well, he hasn't played since November in that Davis Cup match that he limped through against Talon Griekspoor of the Netherlands. Ooh. Which he won.
Points for that, Matt.
Well. Must say, I looked it up earlier.
where was that name when I was trying to remember tennis players last week?
Griekspoor was on the tip of my tongue, but I couldn't recall his first name, so I had to look it up. But I've always thought that the concept of kind of the other British players and actually up-and-coming British players having to play against certainly Andy Murray when he was in his absolute prime would have actually been a cool thing to see, kind of showing those players what it takes, the kind of level they've got to get to the top. Obviously, Murray is using social media to massively play down his chances at the moment, talking about how much he's struggling to move. I mean, I'm interested in whether that's all a bit of a ruse. I think it kind of is, and he's actually going to be well up for it, and I'm kind of expecting him to win, to be honest. But yeah, it is going to be interesting to see what shape he is in, because he was planning to come back in Miami, wasn't he, before the lockdown, to kind of test out the hip and was it a groin?
Test out the hip to see if he needed potentially another surgery. That was something that was, but he mentioned the possibility of, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it is going to be an interesting event.
Well, the first tennis event I ever went to was a national championships in 1995 for work experience with Barry Flatman, former journalist, now retired, but somebody who introduced me to the world of tennis. And when I went through the doors in Telford, the national championships, I decided, yes, this is a career for me. But the event only ran for a few more years before just running out of steam, really. And I think some of the leading players, Tim Henman, came through and then was prioritizing international tennis over the national championships. And it was a shame, really, because it is interesting to watch this kind of thing. I think that Jamie's put together a very, very clever format of having the eight top
British players who were all interesting, and to have Jack Draper in there as amongst them is an interesting element as well, and six doubles teams. On the subject of the event itself and the organisation, I just asked him what that was like, because of, you know, he's used to being a tennis player, and we've worked behind the scenes and we know what it's like. And he did confirm this is, I'm probably more nervous about this than I am about tennis matches that I play, because there's just so many things to think about. I'm waking up in the middle of the night thinking about fridges and all sorts of things I'm supposed to have organized. And he says it has been a bit chaotic at times, but you know, what a baptism of fire. Also asked him, having received an email from Amy Partridge, one of our listeners, who was just talking about the Progress Tour Women's Championships, the women's equivalent of this event, which is due to take place between the 14th and the 18th of July, also at the National Tennis Centre, and they have struggled to get a sponsor so far. So if anybody is interested in sponsoring that, you know, there is an event that's going to take place. Unfortunately, not with Joe Konta there, from what I understand, but there are some leading British players. Katie Bolter, I think, is playing, and several others. And it is a shame in that way that this event, which is going to get TV coverage, it's on the Battle of the Brits this week, is on Amazon Prime. They're going to have full coverage. So it would have been great, wouldn't it, even better to have had an equivalent women's event under the same umbrella at the same time. I asked Jamie just why that hadn't happened. And he said, really, I mean, it's a case of just logistics as much as anything. The time in which they had to get this thing together, and with the restrictions that they have of all the social distancing measures that need to be put into place, it sounded like it was just too big an ask for in the time period that they had. Fortunately, they at least have an event coming along fairly soon afterwards, and hopefully that will be a big success as well. But we wanted to mention that 14th to the 18th of July.
Mm. Well, I look forward to that as well.
Mm, indeed.
Who's going to win the Battle of the Brits, David?
That's a good question. So Liam Brody, Kyle Edmund, Dan Evans, Cam Norrie. A lot of people are bigging up Cam Norrie because he's been putting a lot of practice in.
Is also P.S. Is Paul Jubb not one of the top eight Brits?
Don't know. Don't think he is.
Do you remember when he was a thing?
Yeah, but he's not. Has he played any ATP events? I don't know.
He got the wild card at Wimbledon.
And he's been signed by Murray's agency, actually.
Yes.
Represented by them. And so, yeah, I mean, I think
sounds like he's probably not eligible, but he'd be somebody that I would have been very interested just to see a bit more of.
Jay Clark is playing. And Jack Draper's the one. Aside from Andy Murray, who it's just going to be fascinating to see Andy Murray against this level of competition, see where he's at, given that he just hasn't played. But also just to see young Jack Draper, who was saying that he'd won a practice set against Murray on a tiebreak a couple of days ago, just to see how he gets on, because he's a strapping lad. He reminds me a lot of the time. He reminds me a little bit of Andy Murray in terms of his mannerisms, and also Andy Roddick, but when he was a sort of 17-year-old, that kind of thing.
He's got something that a lot of young Brits, when they break through, are lacking, which is that real swagger. Mm. I mean, I think he treads a bit of a line with it, doesn't it? I'm sure it rubs people up the wrong way, and I'm sure every now and then it can border on arrogance. But I remember watching him in the Wimbledon boys final a couple of years ago, and he just caught your eye. He just had a self-belief which is not necessarily always associated with young Brits coming through, that always seem to have that slightly... What's the word for it?
What's the most delicate way of putting this?
Somebody help me. Well, nobody's helping me. Come on.
You're on your own with this one.
Can I give you one bit of information?
Diminutive? Just help me with anything at this point, David.
Paul Jubb is not one of the top eight players in Britain at the moment. He's ranked 519 in the world, and he's about the British number 15. But he's only 20 years of age, so going in the right direction. And I think as well, he just hasn't played much.
It's just a lack of events.
Yeah.
But I think for Jack Draper as well, this was this was supposed to be the year where he was kind of freeing himself of junior tennis and really trying to give it a go on the, I'm sure, the Challenger Tour, and I'm sure he probably would have got some wild cards.
Picked a good year for it.
Exactly. So, I mean, at least he's now got an opportunity like this on a stage to kind of, you know, give it a go and hopefully show what he can do. Because apparently, I've seen him play a little bit in that boys' final as well, and as much as he's got the swagger, he also has a game. You know, people cite his kind of tennis IQ, and he plays quite smart tennis, I think.
So he's got a lot of shots, hasn't he?
James Ward's playing as well. James Ward just squeaking into the top eight as well. So, it's quite a few generations.
Do you remember that time when we had plans for 2020?
Yeah. I mean, the knock-on effects, I mean, we've talked about it before, the knock-on effects of this situation, the number of people, I mean, if tennis doesn't get back this year and struggles to get back for quite a while, I mean, it may just retire people, mightn't it? Left, right and centre. It's.
I was referencing the Taylor Swift concert that I had tickets for, David, but yes, that too.
What was the Taylor Swift?
That's a
thing?
Shame. Also,
that was going to be a really fun day, wasn't it?
It was women's Wimbledon finals day, followed by Taylor Swift in Hyde Park. It was going to be the best day ever.
I do vaguely remember you asking me, how are we going to do the Wimbledon Daily podcast? Because I've got to go to Taylor Swift.
Yeah, it was going to be great though. I was going to do a mad dash across town, doing a Bucks Fizz style outfit change.
Oh,
anyway,
dear.
All of that's off. I thought I'd record a Wimbledon Relived podcast from home instead.
Yes. Awesome.
Yeah. should we, before I give the big up to Tennis Relived Wimbledon that's coming up in a week or so's time, shall we take a little trip into the past?
Yeah.
It's been a little while since we've done that. You don't get to do this one, David, though.
Uh-huh.
You don't get to talk about the past this time because we've got Andy Murray talking about the past.
Okay.
To you. but it's Andy Murray reminiscing about Queen's 2019, and in particular about his doubles partner at Queen's 2019, Feliciano Lopez, who just, I mean, I still have moments where I think, did that really happen? About Lopez winning the singles and doubles title, about him playing, him participating in, what was it, Matt, the final five matches on the centre court at the Queen's Club last year. The man left his racket bag on court in between the singles and doubles final. He just jogged up the stairs, had a quick shower, jogged back on court. It was absolutely incredible what he achieved last year. It was something that will probably never be repeated, certainly not in those circumstances with the Andy Murray comeback story intertwined with it. So let's hear about that story in the words of Lopez's doubles partner that week, Andy Murray.
I wasn't sure until, you know, like a few weeks beforehand, definitely when I was going to be sort of allowed to play again. I was sort of going based on what the, you know, physios and doctors were saying, and they were giving me certain like targets to hit, like in the gym and stuff, strength wise. So they, you know, they could basically say, yep, okay, we think you're strong enough to allow you to go and compete, basically. So I was just kind of working away, trying to get stronger. And then as it sort of looked like I was going to be allowed to play, we started trying to find a partner for the grass season. And it got, it was just tricky, you know, because obviously a lot of guys were fixed up, and then, what happened with Herbert, like he decided he wasn't going to play doubles. And then I'd asked him if he would play, and he sort of was like, I don't think so. And then sort of came back, said he would play Wimbledon. And then I was like, well, what about the rest of the grass season? Because, I need a partner for the whole grass period. And I was trying to find someone that could play the whole stretch. But that didn't obviously work out. So then we were sort of looking at each tournament and going, right, well, which partner would give me the best chance of doing well, basically. He's one of the better grass court players out there. I mean, his serve's obviously brilliant. And that was kind of how it came about. And, you know, obviously asked him. He was up for it. He'd been given the wild card to singles, and then yeah, that was kind of how it started. But it was really tricky arranging it. You know, I'd never been involved in that sort of you know, the doubles kind of politics and stuff, and double games that go on before. And yeah, it was a few things happened, but yeah, it was good to play with Feli.
He seemed pumped for it straight away. I mean, I spoke to him ahead of it, and I think he liked the idea of kind of feeling, I guess, what you feel for a little bit in Britain and being on the court with you at the same time. Did you sense that he was enjoying the whole process?
Yeah, I mean, since I first came on the tour, I'd always gotten really well with Feli, like always really liked him. And yeah, I'd always chat to him and stuff at the tournaments, always got on well. And then, yeah, when I asked him, like, yeah, he seemed pumped. And I think, you know, at the time, you know, his ranking in singles had dropped. You know, I want to say he was around 100, maybe outside of 100. I'm not sure exactly what his ranking was when Queen started, but, you know, he dropped quite a bit. And, you know, he was sort of talking like this was going to be his last year on the tour. You know, so I think he kind of saw it as like also a nice thing to be able to do, like for us to play together, you know, in Britain, and, you know, playing in front of big crowds and stuff, you know, would be, I guess, a nice memory to sort of finish with. And then obviously he went and did what he did in singles. And
Could you believe that? Aside from what you did as a doubles pairing, a pretty much a scratch doubles pairing, but also the fact that he's gone through the draw, the age he is, playing twice a day.
No, I mean, I couldn't really. I mean, it was one of those things as it was kind of going along, you were thinking, like, you know, is he going to do this? But then, you know, I was expecting the thing that he's very fortunate with, and there's some players that have it and some don't. I personally can't do it, but he could serve for 10 hours in a row and not get tired. He's got such a great motion, like so such an easy motion. There's like very little stress on his arm and his body at all, the way that he serves. So and because that's a huge part of his game, you know, that obviously helps. But I mean, I certainly wasn't like some of the time, you know, when he was playing his singles matches, we were saying, oh, for God's sake, here we go. Like, you know, that, you know, we got no chance. He's going to be, you know, he's going to be tired, like, you know, or, you know, understandably that if he was doing really well in singles, you know, the doubles becomes, you know, for him, yeah, like almost like a distraction in a way. You know, that, you know, you see a lot of the singles guys when they're doing well in singles pulling out of doubles, or, you know, and so we were thinking, you know, maybe, you know, he might not want to play the doubles because he played a lot of long matches in singles that week as well. But yeah, he was like pumped, like really good energy the whole time. And you know, sort of saw him a few times, like in between matches, like in the locker room between matches. And, you know, he looked really tired. Like he was pumped, like in his face, but, you know, he looked tired, like putting his socks on. And, you know, there wasn't huge gaps in between a lot of the matches either. So he was kind of like, he'd come in and he'd sort of shower and he'd be sort of having some food like 20 minutes before he went on. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, that's, you know, you don't want to be having like a bowl of pasta 20 minutes before you play a match. And I was sort of thinking, you know, that might be a bit of a slow start here. But yeah, he served brilliant the whole event. And then also in the doubles, like in the super tie race and stuff, he came up. I can't remember exactly which match it was. I think it was a semi-final where he was just like, at one stage, I think he hit like five or six winners, clean winners in a row, which is, you know, unbelievably difficult in doubles. You know, he served a couple of aces, couple of return winners, like volley winners. So yeah, he played brilliant.
And you would have been up there in the locker room watching while he's playing his singles. Do you find yourself getting at all emotionally involved?
Well, it was actually, it's interesting. I didn't really do that much. What I was doing was, because he wanted to go straight on for doubles after he finished his singles, I was warming up. So I would go and practice like close towards the end of his matches. So I was on the practice court listening to the score and thinking like, right, okay, you know, what, I don't know, whatever, it's, you know, 4-3 in the second set, it's a set up 4-3, so I would be hitting on the court sort of waiting for the match to end, and then obviously most of them went on to three sets, and you know, so I would just sit on the practice court and wait and start warming up again, just hitting balls, because I wanted to come out, you know, as sharp as possible, because I was sort of expecting that maybe after some of the long singles matches that he, you know, might be a bit slow at the beginning. So I was trying to, you know, have my eye in by, yeah, basically practicing right up until we went on the court, which is never normally what players do. You know, you normally finish practice at least an hour and a half, 2 hours before you go on the court. But I was trying to practice right up to the, yeah, right up to the match. So I wasn't actually sitting there, you know, physically watching the match. I was just hearing the score.
Yeah. Just as a final thought, I mean, I know you've won so many different titles and huge titles, Grand Slams, but given what you'd been through and to find yourself on the court with him sharing that, what did that mean to you? And I kind of always wonder about this. Do you then take a sort of bond with you for the future, do you find, with a success like that?
It's interesting, like, you know, one of the things that, I mean, I guess since I've had this kind of time off and then what happened and, you know, at Queen's with Felly was that, you know, I always got on with Felly and, you know, we'd occasionally sort of message and stuff, and when I saw him at tournaments, we would chat, but like, yeah, I mean, we speak to each other like a lot, like we're regularly messaging each other, you know, we went out for dinner like after the final and stuff, which, you know, normally if I won something, I'd celebrate with my team, but not with like another player in his team. And it was really, yeah, like for me, it was just really nice. Like his team were so, so happy, like his coach and stuff. He was on brilliant form like that night. And we like stayed up until, I can't even remember, we're in the restaurant very, very late together. And, you know, his family were there and stuff. And normally you just share it kind of on your own. So it's the first time, I don't mean on your own, but with your own team.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was kind of the first time I'd ever sort of celebrated with somebody else, really, you know, outside of the, you know, maybe like the Davis Cup, for example. And yeah, since then we've stayed in contact and stuff. And yeah, he's been messaging me a bunch, you know, recently. And yeah, it was really nice. And yeah, I guess I also, you know, I had no idea what to expect, like how I was going to play or how I was going to feel or anything at that stage. And, you know, was sort of being told by a lot of people, you know, maybe, you know, press wise or doctor wise, that, you know, it might not work out and it wasn't, you know, it's going to be really difficult, which I, you know, myself thought. But then, yeah, it just kind of happened. And between like that, like Queens and Antwerp for me, like, yeah, obviously the major events and stuff and the Olympics were special, but, you know, that was different because I thought I was at the end, you know, and I had really not enjoyed playing tennis the kind of 2 years previous at all, because, yeah, just because of the pain and discomfort that I was in. And then like really like that week, like, yeah, like I had like that joy back in playing and competing and, you know, smiling and like, you know, it was, yeah, it just felt very different to what I'd experienced the last kind of 7-8 years of my career, where during the matches and everything, there was just always like a stress and a pressure there to win. And if you won one match, it was like you're straight onto the next one. Whereas I felt like, I don't know, that week, like we both like really enjoyed the whole experience together, and each win we, yeah, made the most of. So yeah, it was a cool week for me, and quite different to, you know, some of the other titles I had won.
Oh, lovely stuff. The past was a good place, wasn't it?
It's soothing, isn't it? Just to hear a bit about
the
past.
Nobody wrote me a list of things that happened in 2019 before I got to intro that.
Oh.
But maybe we all remember it. But better things happened in 2019.
I can get Google out if you like.
Let's not dwell on it. Unfortunately, while we were listening to that, some more news has broken.
Hmm.
Hmm. Matt?
Viktor Troitsky has now tested positive for COVID-19. He played the Belgrade leg of the Adria Tour, I believe, and then was due to play an exhibition at Tip Zarevich's academy, I think, and pulled out of that. And there are also reports that his pregnant wife has also tested positive.
Which furthers the uncertainty around, you know, who's the patient zero here, just because Grigor Dimitrov is the first one to show symptoms and test positive, certainly the first one to publicly announce that he had tested positive, at least. That doesn't really mean anything in terms of the trajectory of this thing and how it started and spread at those events. So it's all incredibly worrying. And unfortunately, Matt, the nadir.
This is what I'm talking about.
Might be yet to come.
Well, let's hope they all, I mean, obviously it goes without saying, but we'll say it anyway. Let's hope they all get well soon, that it's not serious. I mean, it's so alarming, isn't it? And to just hear this number of people all in this situation testing positive. Let's hope that's the end of it. But, oh dear, gets worse.
And we don't know the long-term implications of this virus as well, which is yet another worry. You know, I mean, who knows what it could do to their bodies? You know, we don't know that yet. So, you know, let's hope not only they get over it now, but also that they're able to compete as normal in the future and continue to be high-profile athletes.
Absolutely. We wish them all well. And for Matt's sake and the world, hope that this is the nadir of the catastrophe. But we've learned not to take anything for granted. But I'm just going to close my eyes and live in June 2019 for a little while.
Yeah, I got to speak
to... It seemed lovely.
I got to speak a lot to Feliciano Lopez last week because, I mean, I'm the media director at the Fevertree Championships at Queen's. I can't be looked at as an objective person where it comes to that event. I've always loved it. I've always worked at it for the last 25 years. And that's it's lovely to remember those scenes that Andy Murray talked about just then. But also just at the same time, I mean, Matt and me have been working on it the last week, just trying to, you know, remind people of what it was like and the social media and that kind of thing. But it didn't take place this year. It didn't take place. We've just finished Queen's Week and it didn't happen. And next week we're going to have Wimbledon and yet we won't have Wimbledon. Thankfully, we'll have tennis relived from Wimbledon here for us every day. And I mean, I hope everybody enjoys it that listens to those shows. But for us, it's a godsend, really, just to have this every day to talk about and think about and relive and watch these matches and enjoy them. But when I think that an event that I've been watching since I was... well, for 35, 40 years on telly, like Queen's, and then have worked at it for the last 25, for it just not to take place, really did once again bring it home to me.
Yeah, I'm going to get all upset if I start talking about Queen's not happening, because it absolutely is my favourite week of the year, really. And I think it's where we all started. I mean, it's important to all of us personally. You know, it's where... I still remember meeting you both in the cafe Cetici, a little French cafe just on the road between Barons Court Tube Station and the Queen's Club. 5 years ago now, and you know I've only got those 5 years of Queen's memories, and it still means a lot to me. You two have both got a lot more than that, and yeah, just when you're at Queen's, you feel like you're absolutely kind of in the slipstream of the tennis season, because everything tennis just consumes you normally in those few weeks. It's the bridge between the French Open and Wimbledon, and yet it's all new because it's grass as well. And to think that we went from last year's high, such a high. I mean, I've never been at a tournament where one player has kind of hijacked it, and it's been their quest to win it. They've literally played the last five matches on the center courts. The whole story, you're kind of writing themselves, my role, social media, you're kind of in a way hoping that this great story comes off, because it's something that, you know, people are going to connect with. And then to go from that to absolute nothing this year is just difficult to take, really.
Not nothing, Matt. We've got Living in the Past and talking about catastrophic tennis. What is even... There's not even a word for it, is there? Just... I was going to say misstep, but my God, it's more than a misstep. Yeah. Well, we're starting Wimbledon Relived on Monday. We can't wait. What's our first... What is the first match that we'll be reliving?
1978 it is. We're going back to Martina Navratilova against Chris Evert, and we're also within that show going to cover the Martina Navratilova Wimbledon story, nine Wimbledons that she's won, ending in 1990 against Zina Garrison.
Well, that is a bang.
Yeah.
We are starting with a bang. But before that, we'll be back with at least one podcast on Thursday. We're going to talk about Battle of the Brits, et cetera, et cetera. Possibly more. I mean, how many can David squeeze in between now and then? That is not a, it's not a challenge,
well,
David.
How many days are there between now and then? And there's your answer.
Plenty to get stuck into. Awesome.
We'll be back, don't know, soon.
We have
sure.
a quiz to write, Catherine.
We've got a quiz to write for our predictions level quick Kickstarter backers. We're running a Wimbledon quiz on Saturday. So I hope you can, if you are one of those backers, Sunday. you can join us Sunday. Sorry, I said Saturday because it was going to be Saturday, but Matt said he would quite like to watch Leeds Fulham. So for all you
regretting,
for all you predictions backers that would have really preferred the quiz to be on Saturday,
too bad.
That is what's happening. You can sit there imagining Matt watching Fulham lose to Leeds, which, fingers crossed, that doesn't happen.
I was going to say, you don't need to imagine that.
Yeah, I'm running this show, Matt, now. I can stitch you up as much as I like. Is that have I forgotten anything? I'm going to say hello to Russell and Brad, parents of Butler, who was our mascot for the year, who's no longer with us, sadly, but is very much in our thoughts and our memories. And Russell and Brad can be our mascots for the year. And if you're listening, Russell and Brad, I assume you are. I hope you are. Hopefully see you on Sunday, not Saturday. but we'll be back before then, soon, with some kind of other podcast. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.